Welcome to the Sourdough Speak. The University of Alaska Broadcasting Services, in cooperation with Alaska Communication Arts, brings you this series of discussions about the history and development of the Great Valleys of Interior Alaska, the Yukon, and the Tanana, and the city of Fairbanks, which developed with the coming of miners during the great gold stampedes at the turn of the century. In this series, the Sourdough Speak, pioneer Alaskans tell you their stories about their lives as they saw and played a part in the unfolding story of Alaskan growth. Now here is your host for this series, Neville Jacobs.
Jeff Studdett came to Alaska from Ireland in 1928 when his family was interested in a dredge operation near Fairbanks. Since that time, Jeff has become a leader in Alaska dog mushing and is also well known for his work in the lumber industry. In today's interview, we'll talk with Jeff about lumbering. Few people realize the importance this industry has had on the early development of Fairbanks prior to World War II. Today's interview will explore some of the work that was required to provide lumber for this growing interior Alaskan city. But before we get into that, we asked Jeff Studdett that question most Alaskans ask first. How did you happen to come here?
What brought me to Alaska was gold dredging. My family were heavily interested in a dredge on Fish Creek. My brother had been up here a few years before me. And when he came, I got the wild idea that I should come to Alaska. I came up here in January 1928. I've only been out of Alaska once since. I had to go home to get come in on the quota, immigration. So I came in, I had a little trouble about doing that, but I thought I went all right, and I never got around to going back home. My wife came here in 34. She would have come before that, but our daughter was seriously ill, and she had to stay home for that time.
Well, you said your family was interested in a dredge on Fish Creek.
Yes, that petered out, though. After a couple of years, unfortunately, gold was only $20 an ounce, and we just couldn't make it. 2 years after, we lost out there. Gold went to $35, and we would have made out very nicely if we had been able to stay there, but we lost out. So I went to work in, I believe, 1931, but I'm not too sure, of the date for Independent Lumber, and I have worked for Independent Lumber off and on, mostly on, since that date.
He said we had heard there was a great deal of logging in the early days, but thought most was for firewood.
No. All the homes.
All the business for the homes that were
so,
there.
Yeah, all the homes. Yeah. The firewood was a completely different operation. That was just small trees, and that was largely hauled in with. When I first came here, it was all horses, and then tractors were just starting, but there were not very many of them, and there was quite a lot of coal. Of course, the Healy mines were in operation, but there was still lots and lots of wood sawed here.
So you said there was a molding there that
we used to make. Oh yeah, they made moldings and everything up here for the houses. All your door casing and all that stuff was originally all manufactured here. Because for many, many years, up to 1923, when the railroad came in, everything had to come up to Yukon.
Yes.
And they were too busy getting each and important things to ship much lumber. Of course, I wasn't here quite then, but I think that very little lumber was shipped. There were enough trees here to install anything you wanted.
In other words, the early cabins were built of logs, and then were of logs.
Yeah, and then later on there were lots of frame buildings built.
And but then the logging industry developed, and the sawmills went in, and that's when the frame buildings began to
right.
To be
built. Yeah, there were many frame buildings built by the time I got it. Yeah.
I really didn't realize, and I'm sure many people don't realize, that as much lumber was actually produced for construction purposes here.
Oh, everything was produced up to here till the railroad came in. And even then, there wasn't killed much of it. We had 5 or 6 acres up the old independent yard up there in Tent there, and we used to, the wood was, the logs were sawed up, and then they were left to dry in a rough stage for 3 months, and then they were, the lumber was planed, and then it would dry for some more, and the good stuff, the clear stuff, was picked out, and they would make moldings out of that, and sluice boxes for mining. All the sluice boxes were made out of local. And even in the coal mining up here, at first, Cap Lathrop, when he opened up at Healy, he was importing fur, but he found out that the local spruce would stand the beating better than the fur. And then he bought, he used to buy a lot of carloads of 2x10s up there. I've hauled many thousands of feet over the depot to send down to Healy.
We asked if the dredges were built outside or of local lumber.
A portion of the dredges, of course, I believe were shipped in, but then they did use plenty of local lumber. The FE Company was a very big buyer from independent lumber, and all the mining outfits here, they bought. And there was a lot of mining in those days, too, and they... by the time I got help, Independent was the only, practically the only sawmill left. I say there was one for 2 or 3 years there, called the Miners Lumber Company that Sig Wold had. But apart from that, that was the, for 20 years or probably, that was the only major source.
This would have been through the 30s and 40s.
Yeah, the 20s and 30s into the 40s. Then they started, Malone had a, it was a Malone Lumber Company, and then there was a Fairbanks Lumber Company. And then we shipped quite a bit of lumber, too, in at one time from Canada. Mr. Brooks, that has the Brooks Lumber now, he used to haul a lot of lumber into us. Independent was quite a large outfit those days. That's to say, we used to have around 35 men in the summertime. When I first went to work, there was practically nobody in winter because there was nothing to do about 2 men there in winter. But that's at the mill itself. Of course, there were the logging crews out all the time. And it was really one of the major industries of the town because mining and the logging were the only two local deals up here. And that went on for many years. We had to finally abandon it after construction got going up here for the simple reason that there wasn't enough in it where we could compete with the construction wages. I mean, lumber, you couldn't get that much for your lumber is where you could compete with the construction wages.
The price of wages up here went up. It became more economical to import lumber.
It was the only thing you could do because, another thing too, sawmill was getting old and it was impossible to get parts. And furthermore, it wasn't economical, which was all run we burnt all the slabs and edgings and sawdust. We used all that for power, but that took handwork, and wages were just too expensive. Furthermore, we had the third best sawyer on the small log sawyer on the West Coast, and a very good steam man. He was an old Englishman, and then we had a German that took care of the planer work, and he was an artist too, and he made all his own knives and everything for making the molding. You show him what you want and he would grind things down. Well, we lost all these men, and consequently we were just not able to operate like we used to.
I see.
And that was one of the reasons. And the other reason is that, as I say, too many people would come up and work for a short while, and then they'd get a big offer for construction, and then they were gone.
Going to a higher wage industry.
Yeah, they were getting so much higher wages in construction.
How many people were involved say it's in the 20s or the 30s when this was running full tilt?
About 35 in the summer. And then the loggers depend. We don't know how many were actually involved in logging. Probably 20, 25 men altogether.
I see. So perhaps 50, 60 men were involved in the logging.
But as I say, there were different parts. Although, the logging crew would then be back in the summer. A lot of the logging crew would be back driving the logs.
Log drives in the interior of Alaska. Paul Bunyan gets around. We think of log drives in Maine or Minnesota, but in the Tanandaw Valley, that was a new idea. He asked Jeff where the logs came from.
Up the Chena and up the Salt Jacket.
That's quite a ways to the Salt Jacket.
Oh, it was. It used to take approximately 6 weeks for a drive in the summertime. But they bring down quite a few logs, maybe 8,000-10,000 logs.
How far in miles would that be?
It'll be over 100 miles. By the river to the Moose Creek Bluff. The logs used to come down there before they put the dike in, you know, along there. That was 35 miles, which again 16 on the road. And all Alaskan rivers are very crooked. They wind, and it was quite a little job driving those logs. You used to, as soon as the water was right in the spring, they'd start.
Well, now, when would they actually cut the timber?
During the winter. It was all cut in the winter. And then it would be, get it out to the riverbank and piled in what they call log decks. And then when everything was set in the summer, then they would start rolling the logs off the decks. And then when they were all in the river, the crew, which usually consisted of 5 men, 2 poling boats with 2 men each, one would work each side of the river. And then the cook, the 2 boats were fastened together, and that was the cook shack, and he packed the bed rolls and all that, anything, and they had a tent over that. And he would follow along behind.
And this was sort of a raft?
It was a regular boat, a regular poling boat, but they would be, they would have boards nailed across them and a table in the middle. And so it's,
Now, would they raft together the logs? Would they tie them together?
Oh, no, the logs were all loose.
They were all
loose? No, you couldn't handle them in our river. And then we would have what is known as shear booms in various places. A shear boom is something that is used to push the logs from one side of the river to the other. Otherwise, you need the logs in certain places, go in certain channels, or to keep off bars. So you would have these shear booms, and then you'd have a pocket boom. That's one where they tap the logs and divert it into another screw.
I see. Now, would they also a pocket boom would divert it into a slough?
Yeah.
But if you wanted it to go into a channel. So
well, a channel and a slough, thank
you. Oh, I see.
Yeah, we call them sloughs, but we would divert them. See, they came out the Salt Jacket, for instance, going that way, into the main Tanandaw, and then they were taken out of the Tanandaw into a couple of different sloughs, which finally brought them into the pile driver slough, and then the pile driver sloughs came all the way to Fairbanks.
The waterways around Fairbanks are more complicated than they seem at first glance. The reference to pile driver slough brought questions on the side. It seems that at one time, a channel of the Tanandaw River converged with the Chena River, and milky water flowed past Fairbanks where the relatively clear Chena now runs. This channel of the Tanandaw River was encouraged by the people of Fairbanks in the early days to provide more water for riverboats. Then later on, it was cut off by a dike. Jeff explains.
Before they could build a dike was one of the things they had to get permission from Independent Lumber to say that they could block that off, that we didn't want to log there anymore. Otherwise they could not have done it. You see, that was a river that was used commercially. But it was quite a little job. The original pile driver, which I don't think quite a few people realize, they got the name from the fact there wasn't enough water in the Chena Slough for boats to come up here. You know, everything came up by boats in the early days. So they went up to the head of the pile driver, so they went to the Tanandaw in the wintertime, and drove a bunch of piling out from the Tanana, which diverted Tanana water down the Five Rivers Slough. And that gave extra water in the Chena here.
What happened then to log driving, we wondered, after the pile driver slough was diked off?
That ended then, that logging up the salt jacket. And then they started hauling logs in by truck. In the early days, they didn't have any trucks big enough to handle large quantities of logs. But later on, what is now Airport Road was originally a logging road put in by Independent Lumber. And we crossed the Chena down at Pike Landing and went down in what is part of the Chena Ridge Road now and over into, went right over the hill there, down in the basin there on the other side off the town and all that.
And were these being hauled in by?
They were hauled in by truck.
I see.
They used to work night and day in that some years. A couple of fellows, the name of Johnson and Hall, had a contract there and they put two or three years there. They put as much as 1,000,000 feet, which is quite a little for the community here in during the winter. They would have 3 trucks going more or less night and day, and they get going.
1,000,000 board feet in one winter sounds like a great many logs and a lot of work for the sawmills. We asked what the sawyers cut.
Everything except the clear lumber and the molding. And in the early days, they made their own molding here. But later on, when they would get molding in from Juneau and from the outside.
Well, now, how many sawmills actually operated?
At one time, I understand there were 7 sawmills here. Of course, that was before my time in Fairbanks. When I got here, it was just the 1 sawmill, and then at other times, there have been odd sawmills around here. Sig Wold had a sawmill here for a couple of years over in the railroad area. That was when they brought logs in on the, they used to bring some logs in on the railroad, but it was comparatively expensive. The cheapest way you ever could bring them in was to float them, of course. And float them down the river, which is much the cheapest way to bring them logs.
Now, when you brought them in down the stretch of the Tanana, that is now really the Chena River, what happened to them?
Well, they just floated all the, they were floated, they were put in the river and they were followed down by these drivers. They'd keep on, when a log would get stuck in the bank, they'd pull it loose and shove it back in the middle of the river and keep on just following them down all the way. But they got down to Fairbanks here, and then we had a big boom up where the radio station is, and there we would catch the logs as they came in, and then, of course, they'd be sawing them up all the time and keeping the number down.
We asked Mr. Studdard if he had ever driven logs himself.
I never actually was a driver, although I have helped at different times with the drives. I mean, I never actually was one of the regular drivers. I knew how to do it and all about it, and helped on it a lot. But I used to be, I used to have to go out to Salt Jacket every year, well, for several years. I had a spot on the bank there where I had to see that the logs didn't jam up, so they kept on going down the slough. If they jammed up, then you got in serious trouble. The ones behind it plug up, and they'd all start, we'd lose them down the Tanana. This slough that we took them off there from the main Tanana was comparatively small, probably 30 feet across, and you had to be on the ball. There was usually 3 or 4 of us up there when the log drive was in progress, keeping these logs moving down. If you wanted to change the logs from one river to another, you had to divert them into with a shear boom into a pocket boom. A shear boom is set up in such a way that it hangs at an angle across the river. It's a little hard for me to describe in words how it works, but it is made in such a way that you can adjust the angle at which it crosses the river, and a log hits it, and you change it from course from one side of the river, it slides down one side of the river to the other. It was made up of squared timbers, all put together. You could walk on it. It would be 4, usually We had them as long as 1,200 feet. I mean, it was going cockeyed across the river. There you go. I've worked the logs from one side of the river to the other.
All right, now, you used one of these booms to swing the logs into powder out of sleep.
Yes.
And where was it you said that you would have to watch them, that you would lose them down the Panama?
Out at back of what is now the Boondocks Bar. We did one summer lose a couple of thousand logs with a high water. The high water in the Panama and the high water in the Tina at the same time washed out the booms. However, funnily enough, logs don't travel very far, and they all stopped within about 4 miles where they went out in the Panama. And during the winter, they went and, with a tractor, they went and they had them all located, and they hauled most of them over and put them back in this group during the winter.
What size logs are these?
They vary. Probably, say, at 2 foot, they're not too big. A 2 foot log is a pretty good log, but they wouldn't be anything under 14 inches. They didn't cut small stuff. And they were various lengths. They were cut 12, 14, 16, 18, and 20. With a few longer ones, but not very many. Logging down the river where they haul them in with trucks, and they would cut long logs on that because it's easier to haul a 32-foot log, and you can haul a lot more of them on the truck and the dolly than you can for a short log.
Mm-hmm.
But to handle them down the river, a long log would catch too much. I have seen quite a few, but not too many logs of 36 inches. That was a pretty good log for up here, at least by the time I got here. But you would think with seven sawmills here at one time, and all the best of the stuff is cut out.
This means there is second-growth timber covering many hills around Fairbanks. We wondered if any logging had been done up the Steep Highway, too.
Well, not the Steep.
No.
Nothing was ever cut on the Steep. If you go from here to Chena Hot Springs,
mm-hmm.
Yes, and also up to South Fork. Mm-hmm. And that was all being cut quite a bit, but there was no way to haul it, you see. You couldn't do much hauling with horses, except out the riverbank. So it's only when they got into the trucking business that they were able to haul from downriver. Lots of good ones down in, I can't think of the name of the place, I know it's well down there. Downriver, there were lots of good logs, real good logs. But in the old days, you couldn't bring them back upstream.
No, before the trucks, you couldn't get logs downriver from Fairbanks. But those days of rafting logs from upriver must have been exciting. When spring breakup came, the lumbermen were ready to go.
So that was quite a job, getting your logs down. The minute the ice was out of the river, they'd start getting in the nearer logs so you could stop the sawmill. The logs were contained in these booms that I was telling you about, and the booms would have to be, about this time of the year, you dig out your booms, take the snow off, and then you scatter ashes all over there so that they would thaw out, and they wouldn't go down with the ice. In those days, there was far, far more ice going down the river than there is now. There's huge cakes of ice to go from one side of the Tina to the other, great big cakes. But now there is so much more warm water coming in than there used to be. And then we used to be getting the ice from some Tanana ice, too, you see, come down the pile driver through. Now all you've got is ice from the Tina, and there the base warms that up quite a bit, you know, and everything going in there keeps warm. So you don't have the great chunks of ice that you used to see in the old days.
The old-timers agree that there was a great thrill in seeing the big ice breakup in the spring, and the presence of the city has caused changes. Of course, the dike stops any log runs into Fairbanks, as Mr. Studdard explained. A few sawmills continue to operate in the Fairbanks area, but they primarily manufacture round logs and timbers. The early mills were a little different, Jeff explained.
You see, we made everything up there. It was sort of custom. You'd come up and say, for instance, when they built the Mini Street Bridge over here, I remember Beck Construction coming up and they wanted hundreds of 4x12, and that's a pretty good chunk of pretty good chunk of wood there, and they wanted several hundred of those. And so we just cut them special for them. And the logs, we used to have logs up there that were up to 35 feet long and on the bank. And somebody, you'd have an order for this special stuff, and they would cut the logs the necessary length, and then when they got in the mill, the sawyer would cut them whatever was necessary for this special order.
Now, I've heard of cruising timber in the woods up here. Did anybody ever cruise timber?
Oh, yes, definitely. Heaven, yes, because you'd never go into a log without cruising it, because you, you're not going to go up there and take your men up and maybe a patch of little patch of good stuff here, but it wouldn't pay you to go in there, you know, and just cut that out if you didn't have enough logs in these places to keep you going all winter.
So that the specific selection was made.
Oh, definitely. Yes, because otherwise they didn't make too much out of it. They'd never made anything if they hadn't known what they were going to do ahead of time.
Well, now who would cruise the timber, say, for independence?
The various, what's called gypo loggers, they do their own, and it would be inspected there. I remember the gentleman's name, Carlisle, he used to go around and check to see that you logged and didn't cut down a lot of small timber and just leave it lay there. You know, you cut what you had and you cut it down as far as you could and you piled up the rest of it there. They were not selective just like it is outside, but still comparatively selective.
In the territorial days, was there any concern of the government for the land, for the lumber itself, or for the forest? Was there U.S. Forestry Service after
this? Well, they had this man, Carlisle, was checking on it. He used to go by dog team all over Alaska. That was the only way. To go from here to Ruby was, to go from here to Ruby and then down various places around over in the Iditarod, wherever he had to go. You see, it wasn't too hard to go places with a dog team, because there was a dog team trail everywhere. And there were roadhouses along there. There were places to stop all the way down the Tanana.
While you were working for independent, you were also involved in the dog business in a way.
Well, just in the wintertime. Just in the wintertime, I didn't have anything else to do, more or less.
Now, when you're waiting for a summer to drive logs, what's better way than to spend the winter driving dogs? In our next interview, we'll continue talking with Jeff Studdard about his experiences in dog marching and hear what it feels like to stand on the runners of a sled behind a team of racing dogs. This is Neville Jacobs inviting you to join us in our next interview with an Alaskan pioneer.
You have been listening to The Sourdough Speak, a series of discussions about the history and development of interior Alaska in taped interviews with pioneer Alaskans. The Sourdough Speak was produced by Alaska Communication Arts in conjunction with the University of Alaska Broadcasting Services.